I can keep secrets. Franny didn't like to talk about it. She's so private. She admitted to me once that she had kept on writing to him all these years, as if he was still away on holiday. She said she felt silly about it, because she knew perfectly well that he'd died, but that it was nice to keep writing to him. She'd seal the letters up and put them in a drawer. She told me she'd address them, but she didn't go so far as to waste her money putting stamps on them. So we agreed that proved she wasn't completely deluded. It was just a funny little quirk of hers. "And you never said a word," marveled Alice. The fact that her mother had kept a secret was more surprising than the secret itself.
"Although she has let the cat out of the bag now," chortled Roger.
"Only because Franny told me she intended to tell the girls now," retorted Bob. "Apparently she started to tell you and Elizabeth the whole story just a few weeks ago, but then you had to go pick up the children."
"I don't remember," said Alice, her catch cry. "Anyway, she's finally found love again."
Barb sighed and shook her head regretfully.
"If only it hadn't taken so long."
"She's probably just fussy," said Roger. "Needed to find the right fellow, like you."
"Oh, you," said Barb flirtatiously, and she gleamed with happiness. "I was lucky to find you."
"Dad was lucky to find you," said Nick,
suddenly serious. Alice's mother looked up at him with surprise, her cheeks pink with pleasure.
"Well, that's a lovely thing to say, Nick."
Maggie appeared again, wearing a long apron that said, "Mega Meringue Day" on the front, with a picture of a huge lemon meringue pie. Underneath it said, "Mother's Day, Sydney, 2008. She was holding another one for Alice.
"The aprons turned out beautifully, Alice," she said as she slid the apron over Alice's neck and tied it at her waist.
Alice looked around and saw rows of pink-aproned women lining up around the big table with the mixing bowls.
"It looks like we're about ready to start," said Maggie. "Is that okay with you?"
"Sure thing," said Alice recklessly.
"You're over here," said Maggie, "next to me." "Good luck, darling," said Barb. "I do hope they're careful with that oven. It's very easy to burn the meringue on a lemon meringue pie. I remember once I was making one when your father's boss was coming for dinner. I was terribly upset. I remember looking in the oven and thinking..."
"Come on, Barbie," said Roger, pulling on her arm. "You can tell me the rest of the story while we're sitting down."
He winked at Alice as he guided her still chattering mother into the audience, and Alice was filled with affection for him. He loved Barb in his own self-satisfied way. He loved her.
"I'll get the kids to come and sit down," said Nick, and he headed off to the children's area.
Alice went to stand beside Maggie behind the tables.
"What an event," said the woman standing next to Alice.
She had a birthmark like a burn across the bottom half of her face.
"You're a bloody marvel, Alice."
"I'm a bloody marvel," thought Alice. Her head was feeling fuzzy. Nora stood at the microphone.
"Can everybody take their seats, please? The baking is about to commence."
Alice found Nick in the audience. He had Olivia on his lap. The fairy wings she'd insisted on wearing that day were brushing against his face. Tom was on Nick's left, taking photos with a digital camera, and Madison was on his right, seemingly intensely interested in the proceedings. Nick said something and pointed at Alice, and all three children beamed and waved in her direction. Alice waved back, and as she did, Dominic and Jasper caught her eye. They were sitting just two rows behind Nick and the children, and waving enthusiastically as if they'd thought Alice had been waving at them. Oh dear. Now she could see Libby and Ben waving at her, along with Franny, Xavier, Barb, and Roger. Alice tried to make her smile and wave seem all-encompassing and personal to each of them. Nora was speaking again. "I'm stepping in on behalf of Alice Love to be your host today. As many of you know, Alice had an accident at the gym last week and isn't feeling 100%. You know, I can still remember the day Alice said to me that she wanted to get 100 mums together to bake the world's largest lemon meringue pie. I thought she was nuts." The audience chuckled. "But you all know Alice.
She's like a bull terrier when she gets an idea in her head. There was appreciative laughter. A bull terrier? How had she changed so much in just 10 years? She was more like a Labrador, anxious to please and overexcited. But just a few months later, no surprise, here we are. Let's put our hands together for Alice. There was a burst of enthusiastic applause. Alice nodded and smiled fraudulently. We are dedicating this day to a very dear friend and member of the school community who we tragically lost last year, said Nora. We're using her lemon meringue pie recipe, and we're sure she's here with us in spirit today. I'm referring, of course, to Gina Boyle. We miss you, Gina. A minute's silence, please, for Gina. Alice watched as people reverently bowed their heads and remembered the woman who had apparently been such a significant part of Alice's life. Her own mind was blank. This morning's pancakes sat uncomfortably in her stomach. After what seemed much longer than a minute, Nora lifted her head. "Ladies," she said, "pick up your whisks." Chapter 31. The women picked up their whisks solemnly as if they were musicians in an orchestra. "Whisk the eggs, cream, sugar, lemon rind, and juice until combined," read out Nora. There was a pause, and then everyone put their whisks back down and began to select ingredients. Alice cracked her eggs one after the other into her bowl. All around her, women were doing the same thing. There were nervous giggles and whispers. "Don't get any eggshell in there," called out someone from the audience, to much hilarity. After a few minutes, the sound of brisk whisking filled the marquee. Under Nora's instructions, once they were all finished, they stood in line to pour their mixture into a huge yellow industrial vat. "This is going to be an absolute disaster," thought Alice. "Place the flour, almond meal, icing sugar, and butter into a food processor, and process until it resembles fine breadcrumbs," read out Nora. "Instead of using a food processor, we're going to use a concrete mixer. Don't worry, it's clean. So could each mum please place her combined ingredients into the mixer?" "I can't believe we're doing this," whispered Alice to Maggie, as the mothers lined up with their bowls of ingredients. "It's madness." Maggie laughed. "It's all you're doing, Alice." One of the bemused workmen operated the concrete mixer, while the mothers separated yolks from whites. "Add the egg yolk and process," ordered Nora. Once again, the women lined up to add their egg yolks. A few minutes later, a massive glob of yellow dough was upended from the concrete mixer and onto the floury surface of the center table. "Knead until smooth." The women gathered around the table, kneading and pulling at the dough. "This pastry is going to be inedible," thought Alice, watching inexpert hands pushing and pulling. Cameras flashed. "Now we really should be putting the pastry into the fridge for half an hour, but today it's all about quantity rather than quality," said Nora. "So we're going to go straight to rolling out the pastry." The workmen carried over the giant rolling pin. Alice stood back and watched as three women stood on each side of the rolling pin, took a firm grip of the handles, and began to push forward as if they were pushing along a broken-down car. There was giggling and shrieking and yelled suggestions from the audience as the women went off in different directions. But incredibly, after a few minutes, the dough began to flatten. It was working. It was actually working. A huge sheet of pastry the size of a king-sized bed was emerging. "Now the hard bit," said Nora. "Line the pie dish." "We'll never do it," thought Alice, as the women gathered around the sheet of pastry and lifted it into the air with their palms flat, as though they were carrying some sort of precious canvas. Every woman had the exact same expression of terrified concentration on her face. "Shit, shit, shit, shit," said the woman with the birthmark as the pastry began to sag in the middle. Another woman rushed to try and save it. They were treading on each other's toes, calling out sharp orders like, "Be careful there, and watch that part there."
No one smiled or laughed until the delicate sheet of pastry was safely placed in the massive pie dish. They'd done it. No serious tears or cracks. It was a miracle. "Hooray!" cried the crowd, and the women shared ecstatic grins as they used their thumbs to push the pastry against the sides of the dish. Next, they covered it with sheet after sheet of baking paper and weighed it down with rice, and the workmen lifted the dish and placed it into the oven. "We'll bake that for 10 minutes," said Nora smoothly, as if it weren't at all surprising that they had got this far. "And in the meantime, our clever mums will make the meringue." The ladies went back to their tables and began to whisk egg whites, gradually adding the sugar as they did so. The tent filled with heat from the giant oven. Alice could feel her face flushing and beads of perspiration forming at her hairline. The fragrance of cooking pastry filled the air. Her head ached. She wondered if she was coming down with the flu. The smell of the pastry was making her want to remember something. Except it was somehow too large to remember. It was like the huge sheet of pastry, too big for one person. She couldn't find an edge to grasp so she could pull it in front of her, but there was definitely something there. "Are you okay?" Maggie's face loomed in front of Alice. "Fine. I'm fine." The pastry show was pulled from the oven to a round of applause. It was golden brown. The baking paper and rice was removed, and the vat of lemon-colored filling was poured into the pastry. Next came the meringue. The women seemed tipsy with relief. They danced around the pie like schoolgirls, pouring their frothy white meringue mixtures over the filling and using wooden spoons to create snowy peaks. More cameras flashed. "Alice," said Nora into the microphone, "do we have your approval?" Alice felt like the world had been wrapped in some sort of gauzy material. Her vision was slightly blurred. Her mouth felt full of cotton wool. It was as though she'd just woken up and was trying to clear her head of the previous night's dreams. She blinked and considered the pie. "Can someone just smooth the meringue over in that corner?" she said, and was surprised that her voice came out sounding quite normal. A woman rushed to obey her. Alice nodded at Nora. "And now, ladies and gentlemen, we bake," said Nora. Maggie's husband gave the thumbs-up signal to the forklift driver. Everyone's eyes were fixed on the magnificent pie as it was lifted by the forklift and slid into the oven. There was a round of applause. "Year 4 has kindly offered to keep us entertained while the lemon meringue pie is baking," said Nora. "As many of you will remember, our dear friend Gina loved Elvis. Whenever she was cooking, she always had Elvis playing. You couldn't get her to play anything else. So Year 4 is going to perform a medley of Elvis hits for us. Gina, honey, this is for you." There was a burst of laughter and cheers as 30 miniature Elvises swaggered into the center of the marquee. They were wearing dark glasses and white satin jumpsuits, complete with sparkly rhinestones. A teacher pressed a button on a stereo, and the children began to dance, Elvis style, to Hound Dog. There was nowhere for the mega meringue mums to sit, so they all leaned back against the long tables. Some of them took off their pink aprons. Alice's legs ached. Actually, everything ached. "Oh, this song is so familiar." "Yes, that's because it's Elvis. Elvis is familiar to everyone." The song switched to Love Me Tender. The sweet, lemony smell of the baking pie was overpowering. It was impossible to think of anything else but lemon, meringue, pie. "That smell is so familiar." "Yes, that's because it's a lemon meringue pie. You know what a lemon meringue pie smells like." But there was something more than that. It meant something. Alice's face had been feeling flushed and hot. Now she felt cold, as if she'd stepped into an icy wind. Oh dear, she wasn't well. She really wasn't well. She looked desperately into the audience for someone to help. She saw Nick suddenly lift Olivia off his lap and stand up. She saw Dominic bounce to his feet, frowning with concern. Both men were making their way past people's knees, trying to get to her.
Now the song was Jailhouse Rock.
The scent of lemon meringue was becoming stronger and stronger. It was going straight up her nostrils and trickling into her brain, filling it with memory.
Oh, God. Of course, of course, of course.
Alice's legs buckled. Elizabeth's homework for Jeremy. I missed seeing Alice collapse because I'd gone outside to the toilet. They had a row of those blue plastic portaloos. I was bleeding. I thought, how fitting that I should be losing my last baby in a portaloo. Trashy and slightly laughable. Like my life.
Chapter 32.
Hi!
The woman who opened the door was smiling delightedly, wiping her hands on a flowery apron, as if Alice were a very dear friend. Alice hadn't wanted to come. She hadn't been at all thrilled when this Gina had moved into the house across the road and turned up the very next day, knocking on their door to invite Alice for high tea. For one thing, shouldn't Alice have been the one doing the asking, seeing as she was the one already living there? That made her feel guilty, as if this woman already had some sort of etiquette point over her. And she could tell, just by looking at Gina, that she wasn't her sort of person. Too loud, too many teeth, too much makeup for the middle of the day, too much perfume, too much everything. She was one of those women who drained Alice of her personality. And high tea? What was wrong with just ordinary old afternoon tea? This was going to be awful.
Hello there, sweetie.
Gina bent down to say hello to Madison. Madison clung to Alice's leg in an agony of shyness, burying her face in Alice's crutch. Alice hated it when she did that. She always worried people might think the kid had inherited her poor social skills from her mother.
I'm terrible with children, said Gina. Terrible! That's probably why I'm having so much trouble getting pregnant.
Alice followed Gina through the house, trying to dislodge Madison, who was still clinging to her leg. There were boxes everywhere, waiting to be unpacked.
I should have invited you to my place, said Alice.
It's okay. I'm the one desperate to make friends, said Gina. I'm going to try and seduce you with my lemon meringue pie.
She turned around quickly and then walked into a box.
Not literally seduce you.
Oh, that's a pity, said Alice.
And then she said quickly, idiotically, That was a joke.
Gina laughed and led her into the kitchen. It was warm and filled with the sweet smell of lemon meringue pie. Elvis was playing on the stereo.
I thought I'd say high tea instead of afternoon tea, said Gina, so we could have champagne. Would you like champagne?
Oh, sure, said Alice, although she normally wouldn't drink in the day.
Gina danced a jig on the spot.
Thank God. If you'd said no, I wouldn't have been able to drink on my own. And, you know, it just makes it a bit easier when you're talking to new people.
She popped the cork and produced two glasses she had waiting.
Mike and I are from Melbourne. I don't know a soul here in Sydney. That's why I'm on the prowl for friends. And Mike is working such long hours at the moment. I get lonely during the week.
Alice held out her glass to be filled.
Nick has started working pretty long hours too.
Alice?
Alice. Nick was supporting one side of her and Dominic was supporting the other. Her legs had turned to jelly.
Back, said Alice.
You've hurt your back? Said Dominic.
No, I mean it's all coming back. My memory is coming back.
It was as if a dam wall had burst in her brain, releasing a raging torrent of memories.
Get us some water, said someone.
Alice had needed a new friend. When Madison was about one, Sophie had broken up with Jack. Such a shock. And she found a new circle of single, glossy, stiletto-heeled friends who shrieked a lot and started their nights at 9 p.m., catching taxis into elegant bars in the city. She and Alice grew apart. And Elizabeth was distracted, sad, never really listening. So Alice's friendship with Gina grew fast. It was like falling in love. And Nick and Mike got on too. Camping trips, impromptu dinners that went on late into the night,
while the kids slept on the sofa. It was wonderful. Gina's twin girls, Eloise and Rose, were born a few months before Olivia. Big brown eyes and snub freckled noses and Gina's bouncing hair. They all played so well together. One year, the two families hired houseboats together on the Hawkesbury River. They moored their boats next to each other, rowed the dinghies across in the moonlight for barbecues on the top deck. Olivia and the twins painted Alice's and Gina's toenails different colors. Gina and Alice went for a swim after breakfast, floating on their backs, admiring their toenails, while Nick and Mike and the kids played Marco Polo. They'd all agreed it was the best holiday they'd ever had. Of course she'd told Gina she was pregnant with Olivia before she told Nick. Nick was in the UK for 2 weeks. He only called twice. Twice in 2 weeks. He was too busy, he said. He was distracted. But they won the account. He got the bonus. We can afford a swimming pool. There, she said to Nick. What did you say? She was trying to say, you were never there. The year of the Goodman Project, Nick was never there. Never there. When he came home, he smelled of the office. Corporate sweat. Even when he was talking to her, he was still thinking about the office. Olivia had 3 ear infections in 3 months. Tom was throwing terrifying tantrums. Overnight, Madison became so nervous about school she was vomiting every morning. That's not normal, Nick. We've got to do something about it. I can't sleep. I'm so worried about it. Nick said, it's just a stage. I can't talk about it now. I've got an early flight tomorrow morning. Gina said, I found a child psychologist who might be able to help. Should you talk to the school principal about it? What does her teacher say? Could I look after the kids for you while you have some special time with her? What a worry for you. Gina was the sort who got involved with things at the school, volunteered for everything. Alice became that sort of person too. She liked it. She was good at it. Mike and Gina were having problems. Gina told Alice every cruel remark, every thoughtless gesture. Mike told Nick he wasn't happy with his life. Alice and Nick had a Christmas party one hot December night. Mike got drunk and kissed that horrendous Jackie Holloway in the laundry. Gina went in to get champagne and found them. Nick and Alice were in bed one night talking in the darkness. Mike is my friend. Are you saying you approve of him kissing another woman in our laundry? Of course not, but there are two sides to every story. Let's just stay out of it. There were not two sides. It's not excusable. He shouldn't have kissed her. Well, maybe if Gina stopped trying to turn him into something he's not. She's not. What do you mean? Because she's encouraging him to get a different job. But that's because he's not happy there. Look, is there any point in us playing out another version of their fights? You playing Gina and me playing Mike. They turned away from each other, carefully, not touching. It was not cherries. It was half a fruit platter. A beautifully presented fruit platter she'd spent the morning making to take to his mother's place. She was rushing around trying to get the children dressed, and instead of helping, he was reading the paper and happily eating his way through the fruit platter as if Alice were the hired help. After Mike moved out, Gina wanted to lose weight. So Alice and Gina decided to get a personal trainer. They joined a gym. They started doing spin classes. The weight fell off them. They got fitter and fitter. Alice loved it. She dropped 2 dress sizes. She had no idea exercise could be so exhilarating. Gina went on a date with a guy she'd met on the internet. Alice minded the kids. Nick was working late. When Gina came home, she was all glittery and flushed. Alice, lying on the couch in her tracksuit pants, felt envious. First dates. How wonderful to experience a first date again. When Nick came home that night, he said, "You're getting too thin." When Nick heard that his dad was dating Alice's mother, he laughed out loud. She's not his type. He goes for eastern suburbs women with fake boobs and big divorce settlements. Women who read all the right books and see all the right plays. Are you saying my mother isn't cultured enough for your father? I hate the sort of woman my father normally dates.
So your dad is slumming it then, with my poor, simple Hills District mother. It is impossible to talk to you. It's like you want me to say the wrong thing. Fine. Dad is slumming it. Is that what you want me to say? Satisfied? Elizabeth had disappeared. Her sister turned into this bitter, angry person with a hard, sarcastic laugh. Nothing as bad had ever happened to anyone else as was happening to Elizabeth. Alice couldn't say the right thing to her. Once she asked if she'd had another embryo implanted, and Elizabeth's lip curled contemptuously. The embryo is transferred, she sneered. It's not implanted. If it were only that easy. How the hell was Alice meant to know all the right terminology? If she invited her to one of the kids' birthday parties, Elizabeth sighed in a way that meant it would be excruciating for her. But she would still come, and she'd look like a martyr the whole time. Didn't offer to help, just stood there with her lips folded together. Don't do me any favors, Alice wanted to say. After the fourth miscarriage, she tried to talk to Elizabeth. She offered to donate her eggs. Your eggs are too old, Elizabeth had said. You really don't know what you're talking about. When Roger proposed to Alice's mother, Nick was angry. Well, that's just fabulous. Wonderful. How is that going to make my mother feel? As if it was somehow Alice's fault. As if her mother had somehow trapped Roger into marrying her. They stopped having sex. It just stopped. They didn't even talk about it. Let's get her outside into the fresh air. She was dimly aware that she was being half-carried, half-dragged out of the marquee. People were staring, but she couldn't focus on anything but the memories rushing through her brain. When she felt her first labor pain with Madison, she thought to herself, they must be joking. They can't expect me to put up with this. But it seemed they did. 7 hours later, when the baby was born, neither she nor Nick could believe it was a girl. They'd both been so ridiculously convinced it was a boy. It's a girl, they kept saying to each other. The surprise made them euphoric. She was extraordinary, as if a baby girl had never been born before. Tom was in the posterior position. She kept screaming at that midwife with a soft, worn face. It's my back. The pain is in my back. And the whole time she was promising herself, I will never, ever go through this again. Olivia was the worst. Your baby is in distress. We need to do an emergency cesarean, they told her. And suddenly the room filled with people and she was being wheeled down a long corridor, watching the ceiling lights flash rhythmically by, and wondering what she'd done to distress her poor baby before it was even born. When she woke up from the anesthetic, a nurse said, "You have the most beautiful baby girl." Madison got her first tooth when she was 8 months old. She kept touching it with her finger and frowning. Tom refused point blank to ever sit in the high chair. Never ever sat in it. Olivia didn't walk until she was 18 months old. Madison's little red hooded jacket with the white flowers. Tom's filthy blue elephant that had to come everywhere with him. Where's Elephant? Have you seen his damned elephant? Olivia ran into the schoolyard on her first day of school, shrieking with joy. Madison had to be dragged out of Alice's arms. Alice walked into the kitchen one day and found Tom carefully stuffing his nose with frozen peas. I wanted to see if the peas would come out of my eyeballs, he told the doctor. They lost Olivia at Newport Beach. The panic made Alice hyperventilate. You were meant to be watching her, Nick kept saying, as if that were the point. That Alice had made a mistake. Not that Olivia was missing, but that it was Alice's fault. Alice, take big, deep breaths. She ignored their voices. She was busy remembering. It was a really cold August day. She and Gina were driving in separate cars home from the gym. Normally, they would have driven together, but Alice had taken Madison to the dentist beforehand. The dentist said there was nothing wrong with Madison's teeth. He didn't know what was causing that ache in her jaw. He'd sent Madison to the waiting room and asked Alice quietly, could it be stress? Alice had looked at her watch impatiently, desperate to get to the gym. She didn't want to miss the beginning of the spin class. She'd already missed a class yesterday because Olivia had some school presentation.
Stress? What did Madison have to be stressed about? She was just impossible.
She probably just wanted to get out of school.
As they were driving home, Madison was whining about having to stay in the gym daycare while Alice and Gina did their class.
I am too old for the creche. It's just stupid crying babies.
Well, you should have gone to school today instead of making up stories about toothaches.
I didn't make it up.
It was a black, stormy day. Lightning cracked across the sky. It started to rain. Heavy drops splattered on the windshield like pebbles.
Mom, I didn't make it up.
Be quiet, I'm trying to concentrate on the road.
Alice hated driving in the rain.
The wind was howling. The trees were swaying about as if they were performing some sort of ghostly dance. They pulled into Rawson Street. Alice saw Gina's brake lights turn red. Gina was driving her wildly impractical 40th birthday present to herself, a little red Mini with white stripes along the side and personalized number plates. Not a family car.
It makes me feel young and crazy, said Gina.
She drove it with the sunroof open and Elvis on full blast.
Alice watched the Mini in the rain and knew that Gina would be singing along lustily to Elvis.
That tree looks like it's going to fall right over, said Madison.
Alice looked up.
It was the liquid amber on the corner. Beautiful in the autumn. It was rocking back and forth, making a horrible creaking sound.
It won't fall.
It fell. It was so fast and violent and unexpected. Like a dear friend suddenly punching you in the face. Like some cruel god had done it on purpose. To be nasty. Picked up the tree and slammed it across the Mini in a fit of temper. The sound was tremendous. An explosion of terrifying sound. Alice's foot jammed on the brake. Her arm flew sideways protectively across Madison's chest, as if to save her from the tree. Madison screamed, "Mommy! Mommy! Mommy!" And then silence, except for the sound of the rain. The beeps for the 1 o'clock news came on the radio. There was a massive tree trunk lying on the road in front of them. Gina's little red Mini looked like a squashed tin can. A woman came running out of her house. She stopped when she saw the tree, her hands pressed to her mouth. Alice pulled over to the side of the road. She put the hazard lights on.
"Stay here," she said to Madison.
She opened the car door and ran. She was still wearing her shorts and t-shirt from the gym. She slipped and fell, hard on one knee, stood up and kept running, her arms flailing uselessly at the air, trying to pull back time to just 2 minutes ago.
"Get her a blanket. She's shivering."
Nick didn't come to the funeral. He didn't come to the funeral. He didn't come to the funeral. The school principal was at the funeral, Mr. Gordon, Dominic. He said, "I'm so sorry, Alice. I know you were such close friends." And he hugged her. She cried into his shirt. He stood close by her while they released pink balloons into the gray sky. She didn't know how to live her life without Gina. She was part of her daily routine. Gym, coffee, taking the kids to swimming lessons, personal training, minding each other's kids, movie nights, laughing at stupid things. Sure, she knew lots and lots of other mums at the school, but not like Gina. She was her one true friend now that Nick was too busy with work. All the joy had gone. Everything seemed pointless. Each morning in the shower, she cried, her forehead against the bathroom tiles, the shampoo sliding into her eyes. She fought with Nick. Sometimes she deliberately picked fights because it was a good distraction from the grief. She had to stop herself from hitting him. She wanted to scratch and bite and hurt him. Nick said one day, "I think I should move out." She said, "I think you should too." And she thought, as soon as he goes, "I'll phone Gina. Gina will help me." The nastiness seemed to begin so quickly and easily, as if they'd always hated each other. And here at last was their opportunity to stop pretending and let each other know how they really felt. Nick wanted the children to be with him 50% of the time. It was a joke. How could he possibly take care of them on his own with the hours he worked? It would be so disruptive for them. He didn't even really want them. He just wanted to reduce the amount of maintenance he would have to pay. Luckily, she remembered that her old friend Jane had become a family lawyer. Jane was going to take him on. 4 months after Nick moved out, Dominic asked her out on a date. They went for a bushwalk in the national park and got caught in the rain. He was easy and kind and unaffected. He didn't know the right restaurants. He liked unpretentious cafes. They talked a lot about the school. He respected her opinions. He seemed so much more real than Nick. They had made love for the first time just the other night at his place. The children were with her mother, the night before she hit her head. It was beautiful. Well, okay, it was awkward. For example, he seemed to think he should lick her toes. Where had he got such an idea? It tickled unbearably, and she accidentally kicked him in the nose. But still, it had been so, so lovely to have a man appreciating her body again, right down to her toes. Dominic was the right sort of man for her. Nick had been a mistake. How can you pick the right man when you're in your 20s and stupid? The grief started to ease a little. It was still there, but it wasn't an impossible weight crushing her chest. She kept herself very busy. She stopped by at Dino's one afternoon for a coffee and found a small crowd of solemn-faced people surrounding a woman having some sort of attack on the footpath. Even Dino was out there. Alice went to avert her eyes. It seemed like the poor woman might be mentally ill when she saw, to her horror, that it was her sister. It was Elizabeth. And when Dino told her what had happened, her first feeling was shame. How could she not have seen that it had got so bad? As she was explaining to Dino what Elizabeth had been through, she felt a growing anger at herself. It was like she'd just come to accept Elizabeth's miscarriages as part of life. She led Elizabeth to her car and left her sitting in the passenger seat, staring straight ahead. And then she'd gone back and managed to soothe the mother of the child Elizabeth had apparently tried to kidnap. It was Judy Clark. Judy had a son in Madison's class. On the way back home, Elizabeth said, "Thanks," and nothing else. Well, enough was enough. This endless cycle of miscarriages had to stop. They were just beating their heads against a brick wall, and Elizabeth was losing her mind. Alice had lost her best friend, and her marriage had fallen apart, but she was still getting on with things. Someone needed to talk sense to Elizabeth. As soon as she got home, Alice got on the internet to research adoption. Last Thursday, she made a fresh batch of banana muffins, and then she rang up Ben and told him she was having trouble with her car. He said he'd be right over. "I wonder if we should call a doctor." "No," said Alice out loud, her eyes shut. "I'm all right. Just give me a minute." Now she was remembering the past week. It was as if she'd been permanently drunk. She was mortified. She hadn't had time for breakfast the morning of the spin class with Jane, and actually, now she thought about it, she hadn't even had any water, which was stupid. No wonder she'd fainted. Her last memory was pedaling hard, sweat dripping, listing off in her head everything she had to do for Mega Meringue Day. Only half listening to Narelle, the annoying instructor, spin-crazy girl, going on about the finish line and the semi-trailer holding you up. Instead, she was watching the television screen play soundlessly above Narelle's head. There was a commercial on that always irked Alice, featuring a woman looking flirtatiously at the camera while licking a glob of cream cheese off the tip of her finger. She looked a bit like Jackie Holloway. And Alice was feeling sick at the very thought of eating cream cheese. That's why her mixed-up brain had been thinking about cream cheese when she regained consciousness. Being carried out of the spin class like that. How completely bizarre that she didn't recognize the gym, or Maggie's husband on the treadmill, or Kate Harper coming out of the lift. The shock of finding she and Nick were divorcing.
talking to Nick's PA on the phone. That awful woman had never liked her. Alice suspected a crush. And since the separation, she'd become quite breathtakingly rude. Dancing the salsa at the family talent night. That chemistry she imagined she felt. Good Lord, she'd given back Granny Love's ring. She'd been determined to keep that ring for Madison. Now it might go to Nick's new wife if he ever remarried. It was part of Madison's heritage. He'd bet her $20 that she wouldn't want to get back together when she got her memory back. He must have been laughing at her the whole time. She had kissed Nick. It made her sick to the stomach. He was using her memory loss to get her to agree to the 50% care arrangement. Thank God she'd never signed anything. For heaven's sake, they'd taken Madison for ice creams and whale watching after she'd cut off Chloe's hair. Talk about the right way to bring up a delinquent. She'd told Mrs. Bergen that she'd switched sides on the development issue. Well, she'd just have to tell her that she'd switched right back. She didn't want to stay living in the house. Too many memories. The developers could knock it to the ground and put up the tackiest, most sterile high-rise apartment block for all she cared. Tom was meant to have been one of the Elvis dancers today. She had his suit already. He deliberately not reminded her. Nora hadn't mentioned the sponsors in her speech. She needed to check all the paperwork for the Guinness Book of Records. Everything had to be done properly or it wouldn't be an official record. Maggie and Nora meant well, but they didn't really know what they were doing. The mum standing next to her with a birthmark was Anne Russell, mother of little Carrie in Tom's class. They helped together at the library on the same day. How could she have forgotten Anne Russell? How could she have forgotten any of it? Alice opened her eyes. She was sitting on the grass of the school oval. Nick and Dominic were both squatting down uncomfortably in front of her. Are you all right? Said Nick. Alice looked at him. He flinched as if she'd hit him. You've got your memory back, he said. It wasn't a question. He stood up. It was as if he were folding up his face, making it bland and cold. I'll go let the kids know you're okay. He started to turn away and then looked back at her and said, You owe me $20. Alice turned to Dominic. He smiled, hugged her to him, and said, Everything is all right now, darling. Chapter 33 Alice was running with her mobile in hand so she wouldn't miss the call when it came. She was running the route that Luke used to take her and Gina on. She'd let Luke go. She couldn't justify spending $150 on a personal training session. Not when she and Nick were still trying to work out the money settlement. She'd also dropped the gym membership. These days, she just liked to run and remember. Since she'd lost her memory and got it back again, she was obsessed with remembering her life. She kept a daily journal, and whenever she went running, she let memories drift through her head. When she got home, she would write them down. It was hard to know whether she'd fully recovered her memory of the 10 years she'd lost, or if there were still gaps. She understood that even before the accident, she wouldn't have had perfect recall of the previous decade. But she kept scouring her mind, searching for any missing pieces. Today she was remembering a night when Tom was a baby. Everyone had told her that her second child would be a wonderful sleeper after the problems with Madison. Everyone was wrong. Tom was a cluster feeder. He didn't like having a proper feed every 3 to 4 hours, thanks anyway. He much preferred a snack every hour. Every single hour. That meant Alice only slept 40 minutes at a time before she was wrenched awake again by the sound of his cry through the baby monitor. And Madison was a toddler, but she still had never slept through a single night in her life. It was a time in her life when Alice was obsessed with sleep. She lusted for it. She saw television ads for sleeping pills, or beds with people sleeping, and they made her want to spit with envy. After feeding Tom, she would half stumble, half run back to the bedroom and dive into the bed. Her sleep would be full of dreams about the baby. She'd fallen asleep on the baby and suffocated him. She'd left him on the change table halfway through changing his nappy, and he'd rolled onto the floor. And then, just at the moment she was sleeping the deepest, most exquisite sleep, the sound of the monitor would wake her again. It was like being desperately thirsty and having somebody hand you a tall glass of ice water and then tear it away from your mouth just as you took a sip. Better not to have any water at all. On this particular night, Nick was leaving early the following morning for an important business trip. She'd just got back into bed after convincing Madison to go back to sleep.
"Why can't I play outside now? Why is it the middle of the night?"
When Tom began wailing, her head swam as she bent over the crib to pick him up. She felt a wave of pure rage at this person who refused to let her sleep.
"Just what do you expect of me?"
Her arms tightened around the baby.
"You need to be quiet."
She laid him back down with elaborate care. Tom was enraged and screamed as though she'd just put him down on a bed of knives. Alice went back to the bedroom, switched on the light, and said to Nick, "You need to lock me up. I wanted to hurt the baby." Nick sat up in bed, his eyes bleary and confused.
"You hurt the baby?"
Alice was trembling all over. "No, I wanted to. I wanted to squeeze him until he stopped crying." "Right then," said Nick calmly, as if she'd just reported something perfectly normal. He got up and led her by the hand back to bed. "You need sleep."
"But I need to feed him."
"I'll give him the expressed milk you've got in the freezer. Just go to sleep. I'm canceling tomorrow. Sleep."
"But..."
"Sleep. Just sleep." It was the most erotic thing he had ever said to her. He pulled the covers up under her chin, unplugged the monitor, and left, switching off the light and closing the door behind him. The room became divinely silent and dark. She slept. When she woke, her breasts rock hard and leaking, the room was filled with sunlight, and the house was quiet. She looked at the clock and saw that it was 9 o'clock. He'd done it. He actually cancelled his trip. She'd slept for 6 straight, glorious hours. Her vision was brighter, her brain sharper. She went downstairs and found Nick giving Madison her breakfast, while Tom cooed and kicked in his bouncer.
"Thank you,"
said Alice, almost delirious with gratitude and relief. "No problem," smiled Nick. She could still see the pride on his face because he'd saved her. He'd fixed things. He'd always loved to fix things for her. So it wasn't strictly true that he was never there, or that he always put work first. Maybe if she'd just asked him for more help. If she'd fallen apart more often so that he could be the knight in shining armor. But how sexist and wrong was that? If she hadn't made herself the expert on everything to do with the children. If she hadn't been so condescending when he'd dressed the children in weirdly inappropriate combinations. He couldn't stand being made to feel stupid. So then he just stopped offering to dress them. His stupid pride. Her stupid pride about being the best, most professional mother. "I might not have made it in your world, Nick, like Elizabeth and all those career women in suits, but I've made it in my world." She'd come to the steepest part of the route, the part that always made Gina use terrible language. Her calf muscles tightened. It was good to remember that for every horrible memory of her marriage, there was also a happy one. She wanted to see it clearly, to understand that it wasn't all black or all white. It was a million colors. And yes, ultimately it hadn't worked out, but that was okay. Just because a marriage ended didn't mean that it hadn't been happy at times. She thought about that strange period of time straight after she'd got her memory back. At first, images, words, emotions crashed over her in violent waves. She could hardly breathe for the chaos. Then, after a few days, her mind had calmed. The memories had fallen into their correct places, and she felt a kind of beautiful relief. Without her memory, she'd been swimming through cloudy water, half blind. Now, she had clarity of vision again.
and what she saw was this. Her marriage was over, and she was in love with Dominic. That was that. With Dominic, she felt the sweet, soothing comfort of being with a man who was besotted by her, fascinated by her, and wanted to find out who she was. With Nick, all she felt was bitterness, fury, and hurt. He was a man who had already decided who she was, who could list all her flaws, annoying tendencies, and mistakes. She could hardly stand to be in the same room with him. The idea that she'd planned to get back together with him was terrifying and shocking, as if someone had drugged her, hypnotized her, duped and deceived her. It wasn't just that her memories of the last 10 years were back. It was that her true self, as formed by those 10 years, was back. As seductive as it might have been to erase the grief and pain of the last 10 years, it was also a lie. Young Alice was a fool. A sweet, innocent fool. Young Alice hadn't experienced 10 years of living. But even as she tried to reason with her, scolded her, and grieved for her, young Alice stubbornly refused to go away. Over the months that followed, she kept popping up. She'd be paying for petrol at the service station and find her hand reaching out for a bar of heavenly lint chocolate. She'd be talking seriously to Nick about complicated logistical arrangements with the children, and she'd find herself asking him something flippant and entirely unrelated to the conversation, like what he'd had for breakfast that morning. She'd be rushing to the beautician and find herself calling Elizabeth to suggest they meet for a coffee instead. She'd be hurrying between appointments, and a voice would whisper in her head, "Relax." Finally, she stopped resisting and called a truce. Young Alice was allowed to stay as long as she didn't eat too much chocolate. Now it seemed like she could twist the lens of her life and see it from two entirely different perspectives. The perspective of her younger self, her younger, sillier, innocent self, and her older, wiser, more cynical and sensible self. And maybe sometimes young Alice had a point. Like with Madison, for example. Before she'd lost her memory, Alice had been going through a bad stage with Madison. She'd been so tough on her, so frustrated by her behavior, and in the deepest, most shamefully childish part of her mind, she had blamed Madison for Gina's accident. If she hadn't had to take her to the dentist that morning, Gina wouldn't have been pulling up at the corner at that time. They would have stopped to have coffee instead. And of course Madison would have been smart enough to pick up on Alice's resentment. She was already a child who felt everything far too deeply. She'd seen her mother's friend killed in an accident, and then her parents separated. No wonder she'd been playing up. Elizabeth recommended a psychiatrist she'd heard about, a Dr. Jeremy Hodges. Madison had been going to see him twice a week, and it seemed to be helping. At least she hadn't assaulted anyone lately at school, and Kate Harper's husband had been transferred to somewhere in Europe, so the Harper family was now thankfully out of their lives. There was a friendly toot of a horn, and Alice looked up to see Mrs. Bergen driving by in her little blue Honda. It was strange, but after she got her memory back, Alice found she'd lost interest in the development issue. The idea of selling up for a nice profit and moving into a fresh new house without memories no longer seemed that important. She knew the bad memories would come with her anyway, and she didn't want to leave the good ones behind. On the other hand, if the developers won, well, that was life. Things changed. Oh, things sure did change. She came to the corner where Gina had died and remembered yet again the terror and disbelief of that moment. Her grief had changed since she lost and regained her memory. It was simpler, calmer, sadder. Before, she had somehow channeled her grief into a whole lot of different directions. Fury toward Nick. He should have taken Gina's side when she was splitting up with Mike. Coldness toward Elizabeth. She never really liked Gina all that much. An irritation toward Madison. Gina would still be alive if they'd driven in the same car. Hearing the facts of her life, "Your friend died," without the memories, had untangled her feelings. Now she just missed her. The phone rang in her hand.
She stopped to answer it without looking at the name on the screen. Heard anything yet? It was Dominic.
No, she said. Stop taking up the phone line.
Sorry, he laughed. I'll see you tonight. I'm bringing a chicken, right?
Yes, yes, go away.
He liked to check things, and double-check and triple-check, just to be sure. It could potentially become an annoying habit, but then everyone had annoying habits. And she wouldn't have even considered asking Nick to do something so menial as buy a barbecue chicken on a weeknight. Nick was too busy and important. When Dominic came over after a day's work, he was totally present. Not like Nick, who would sometimes act as if Alice and the children weren't quite real, as if his real life was at the office. It wasn't as if Dominic didn't have a stressful job too. Nick might run a company, but Dominic ran a school. And which one was contributing more to the community? She just wished she would stop comparing Dominic to Nick, as if all the reasons she loved Dominic was simply because he was so different from Nick. It sometimes seemed as if the whole point of her relationship with Dominic was how it compared to her relationship with Nick. The other day, she and Dominic had been at Tom's soccer game, and Nick was there too. She'd been so aware of his eyes on them from the other side of the field, as she laughed extra hard at Dominic's jokes. She made herself a bit sick, to be honest. The awful thing was that even when Nick wasn't there, she was always imagining him watching. Look at us snuggled up on the couch together watching TV, Nick. He's rubbing my feet. You never did that. Look at us walking hand in hand into this cafe. No fuss about finding the perfect table. We just sit down. Look, Nick. Look. So did that make her relationship with Dominic nothing more than a performance? She slowed down to a brisk walk, panting hard, and remembered how she'd sat in the kitchen drinking wine with Nick, and the blissful relief she'd felt kissing him. Stupid. So mortifying. He'd kissed her back, though. He'd been willing to try again. She had absolutely no desire to try again. None whatsoever. Been there, done that. Time to move on with her life. She had made the right decision. The children loved Dominic. He'd probably spent more time with them than they'd ever spent with their father. And she and Nick were so civil and grown up nowadays. They had finally worked out a shared parenting arrangement that suited them both. Nick wasn't having them 50% of the time, but he was seeing them a lot more than just on weekends. He was actually taking Friday afternoons off from work so he could pick them up from school. Recently, she had found she was actually looking forward to seeing him when he dropped off the children. It was going to be one of those amicable divorces. Yes, a good marriage, if you averaged it all out, followed by a good divorce. According to the children, Nick had a girlfriend, Megan. Alice wasn't exactly sure how she felt about Megan. The phone rang again. At last, it was him. She sat down on somebody's red brick garden wall. "Tell me," she said. "Hurry up and tell me." At first, she couldn't understand him. He seemed to be in the middle of blowing his nose. "What? What did you say?" "A little girl," said Ben, loud and clear. "A beautiful little baby girl." Chapter 34. Elizabeth's homework for Jeremy. I never believed I was going to have a baby until I heard her cry. Sorry to admit that, Jeremy, because I know you worked your heart out trying to stop me from being a basket case. But I never believed it. That day in the Portaloo, while the world's largest lemon meringue pie baked, I was convinced I was having my last miscarriage. But then the bleeding stopped. It was just spotting, as the medical world cheerily calls it. A spot of rain, a spot of bother. But even when the spotting finally stopped, I didn't believe I was having a baby. Even when every ultrasound was normal, even when I could feel the baby kicking and rolling, even when I was going to prenatal classes, choosing a crib, washing the baby clothes, and even when they were telling me, "Okay, you can push now," I still didn't believe I was having a baby. Not an actual baby. until she cried. And I thought, that sounds like a real newborn baby. And now she's here, little Francesca Rose. Through all those horrible years, I hardly ever saw Ben cry.